sea for conscription, and it's C for Capitol Hill. Well, it's C for conscription, and it's C for Capitol Hill. And it's C for the Congress that passed that goddamn bill. Beautifully. I'd rather be at home, even sleeping in a holler log. I'd rather be here at home, even sleeping in a holler log. Then go to the army, be treated like a dirty dog. Diddly.
Returning to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program features Eric Deegans, who is a TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times, and who talks about how the media uses fears and prejudices of their viewers to garner a larger audience.
I wrote on it, noting how these words sounded like an awful backhanded compliment, like he walked into the doors of Sylvia's expecting a scene from a bad rap video. O'Reilly blamed Media Matters for omitting the middle part of his show where he talked about his grandmother's racism, how she had never really known a black person, and how her attitude was rooted in fear translated as irrational hostility. And indeed, the full audio of his remarks veered between some statements that sounded insulting, saying, quote, I think black Americans are starting to think more and more for themselves. They're getting away from the Sharptons and the Jacksons and the people trying to lead them into a race-based culture, unquote, to more conciliatory notes about how prejudice exists because white-controlled media pass along harmful images of black people. What seemed obvious then and now is that we don't have a great vocabulary for talking about any of this, and too often, instead of having a respectful dialogue, we fight. All of which I wanted to discuss with O'Reilly in Sarasota, but my first question, asking why he called me a race baiter, didn't get much response. I don't have that quote in front of me, he said. I'm not going to answer quotes that I said 4 years ago because I don't know what the context is. I can't answer the question because I don't know. If you have a transcript, I'll take a look at it. But you said back then that white people couldn't talk to black people about issues of race, I answered. Do you feel the same way now? All I know is I did a commentary on a restaurant in Harlem, Sylvia's, where I was very complimentary about the restaurant and what went on there. And I got shattered by ideologues who were just looking to take things out of context, he said. I think it's a press problem, not a people problem. Well, then why did you air a commentary blaming the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, Media Matters, civil rights activist Jesse Jackson, and me for helping create a climate where good people are being driven away from constructive dialogue that might advance racial harmony? And why did every example of dubious race baiting he cited feature allegations of prejudice against white people? If we're all equal, can't white people make mistakes too? Later, I asked about the track record of his employer, Fox News, in closely covering issues that may heighten fears of black people, including fellow anchor Sean Hannity making the case that Derrick Bell, the first African-American to become a tenured professor at Harvard University's law school, was a radical extremist closely linked to President Obama. To be honest, I wasn't that surprised that I didn't get answers for my questions. People used to having one-sided conversations sometimes have trouble when the setting is different. Forget about a meaningful discussion on opposing views or allowing people of color the space to initiate debate. Instead, opponents are instantly dismissed with a term whose toxic meaning shuts down all discussion, race baiter. But sometimes such a slur coming from the right people feels less like a criticism than a badge of honor, communicating mostly one thing. You're on the right track. So that's a little bit from the introduction of the book to give you a sense of what it's like to cross horns with my good friend Bill O'Reilly. But it also explains why I wrote the book in the first place, because I feel like a lot of times when you want to have discussions about how prejudice plays out, how racism plays out, how bias plays out in media, people try to turn that around and they try to call you the race baiter. And what I'm doing is I'm trying to reclaim that word a little bit. And each chapter of Race Baiter takes on a different element of this equation. So I started out talking a little bit about MSNBC and Fox News in the first chapter, which is subtitled Downgrading All Journalism in the Race to Win a Political Ratings Fight. Now, the Pew Center for Research did a little poll where they asked a bunch of people, okay, if somebody comes to you and asks you to say a media outlet that just pops into your mind, when you talk about the media does this or the media does that, what pops in your mind? 63% of the time, they said a cable news channel, right? So cable news may not get the lion's share of TV news ratings. I mean, broadcast TV news outlets draw a much bigger audience. When we talk about the media, often we're talking about cable news. And when you have two ideologically opposed cable news channels that are covering the same stories and presenting these wildly different pictures of what's going on, I think that erodes people's confidence in journalism in general. Al Sharpton, I talk about Al a lot in the first chapter, and he was kind enough to give me an interview even after I said on CNN that I questioned whether or not MSNBC should have given him an anchor job, so I got to give him props for at least being willing to talk to me. But I've got to say that some of the things that he does as an anchor and an advocate trouble me as a media critic. In the middle of the Trayvon Martin situation, where Trayvon Martin's family was trying to pressure officials in Florida to charge George Zimmerman, the man who shot and killed him, with murder, Al Sharpton decided to be a spokesman for the family. And so on March 22nd of last year, there was this huge rally in Sanford, Florida. Part of the reason they had the rally was to raise money for the family, to help them press their legal fight. So Al Sharpton was out there getting people to donate money, pressuring and calling for prosecutors to go after George Zimmerman. And then 6 o'clock rolls around, and he stops doing what he's doing. He grabs Trayvon Martin's parents, he gets in front of a TV camera, and he spends an hour hosting his MSNBC show, Politics Nation. Then when that show's over, he goes right back to the rally, and right back to raising money, and right back to pressuring prosecutors to go after George Zimmerman. And now I would ask you, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? What's wrong with Al Sharpton collecting money for Trayvon Martin's family and hosting a show called Politics Nation on MSNBC?
He's becoming part of the story.
He's becoming part of the story, and he has a tremendous conflict of interest, right? I mean, on the one hand, he has a vested interest in seeing that George Zimmerman is prosecuted for this killing. And on the other hand, he's the voice of a cable news channel which hopefully would at least fairly cover this issue, right? That's the kind of conflict of interest as journalism educators and students we're learning about and teaching people to avoid. At MSNBC, 18 months before that, Keith Olbermann and Joe Scarborough got suspended for giving contributions to political candidates without getting a previous okay from NBC News. But here, Al Sharpton is allowed to host a show on MSNBC and then also lead a rally where he's collecting money for the family at the heart of the biggest news story on the planet at the time. No problem there. Now, MSNBC says it's because everybody knows who Al Sharpton is. Everybody knows he's an anchor and an advocate and that he mixes those two roles, and it's not like they're trying to hide anything. But I feel like people look at that and they sort of say, well, he's got an agenda. Everybody's got an agenda, right? And George Zimmerman sued NBC News because another part of NBC News made a mistake when they edited audio of a 911 tape where George Zimmerman was talking to Sanford police. And they made it look like he had focused on Trayvon Martin because of his race in the call. So now, anybody want to take bets on whether or not what Al Sharpton did on MSNBC is going to come up during that trial? And what happens if NBC News loses a multi-million dollar judgment because they were able to talk about some unfairness exhibited on another branch of NBC News? See, this stuff can be very complicated. One chapter of the book on Fox News talks about how I feel their focus on scary black people leaves race relations as collateral damage. One group that Fox News seems to like to cover is the new Black Panther Party. I was watching election coverage in November, and on election day, they seem to keep cutting back to this voting area in Philadelphia, where this guy who was a member of the new Black Panther Party was also volunteering to help people. You know, he's opening the door so people could come in and vote. I guess he might explain the ballot to them if they had questions, but he was standing out in front of the polling place, opening the door for people and standing there as a volunteer. As far as I know, they were the only news outlet that was continually cutting back to this polling place. And why are we spending so much time looking at this guy from the new Black Panther Party? They're a very small group. They don't have very many members. They've been criticized as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. They're anti-white. They have problems with Jewish people. You know, they're a hate group in a lot of ways, but they're also very small and they don't have a lot of influence. So why is Fox News talking about them so much? Well, because Fox News's core audience, their target audience, the people that they're that niche that they're super serving, is mostly middle class, mostly middle aged, a little bit more male than female. And what is one of their greatest fears? Scary black people, right? So if you create a channel where you're evoking that point of view and you're realizing that culture and news coverage, one of the things you're going to do is you're going to talk about greatest fears, right? That there's this black president who secretly supports or is being supported by this anti-white black hate group. Whether or not it makes any sense, whether or not there's any real context to it, whether or not it deserves that kind of coverage.
Tune in to great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays on Access Sacramento, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. See the big picture on financial, military, environmental crises, war and peace, the economy, and climate change are covered. And then there's music and humor. Challenge your thinking with great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Well, I'm going to preach all a sermon about old man Adam, and I don't mean the Adam in the Bible, Dadam. No, I don't mean the Adam that Mother Eve made it. I mean the thing that science liberated. The thing that Einstein says he's scared of, and when Einstein's scared, brother, I'm scared. Well, if you're scared of the A-bomb, here's what you got to do. You got to gather all the people in the world with you, because if we don't get together and do it, well, the first thing you know, we'll blow this world plumb to Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Alamogordo, Bikini. Now life used to be such a simple joy. The cyclotron was just a super toy, and folks got born, they'd work and marry, and atom was a word in the dictionary. And then it happened. And the science boys from every clime, they all pitched in with overtime, and before they knew it, the job was done, and they'd hitched up the power of the gall-darned sun and put a harness on old Sol, splitting atoms, while the diplomats was a-splitting hairs. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Alamogordo, Bikini. But the Adams International, in spite of hysteria, flourishes in Utah and in Siberia. And whether you're black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. And the answer to it all ain't military, datum. Like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms? No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta stick together or disintegrate. We hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, bloody up the flue, Alamogordo, Bikini, it could happen to you. Yes, it's up to the people, because the Adam don't care, and you can't fence him in, he's just like air, and he doesn't give a hoot about any politics or who got what into whichever fix, because all he wants to do is just sort of set around and have his nucleus bombarded by neutrons. So the moral is this, just as plain as day, that old man Adam is here to stay. He's gonna stick around, that's clear to see, but ah, my dearly beloved, are we? So listen, folks, here is my thesis. Peace in the world, or the world in peace. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Alamogordo, Bikini.
Now, this is Fox Nation, is a blog that's connected to Fox News Channel. It tends to be more extreme than the stuff that you see on television. But when President Obama held a dinner at the White House and he had some black celebrities come along, all of a sudden it was defined as a hip-hop barbecue. And for some reason it was expected to create jobs and people were disappointed that it didn't. I don't really understand why hip-hop barbecue is supposed to create jobs. And in fact, I don't understand why, if it's a hip-hop barbecue, there's really only one rapper shown, who is Jay-Z. But again, you get a sense of how the audience's views on race dictate their strategy. The Brookings Institution produced a big study that I footnote in the book and talk about in the book a little bit. And as part of that, they asked people whether or not they thought it was an equal chance that white people could be discriminated against because of their race as black people or people of color. And they found that 46% of the people they polled felt that there was an equal chance that white people might be discriminated against because of their race as people of color. But when they asked people who watch Fox News regularly, that total jumped to 70%. Right? So this is an audience that essentially doesn't really believe in institutional racism, doesn't really believe that racism is holding people of color back any more than anything else is holding white people back, right? And so they're going to, if a channel is going to speak to that audience, they're going to have that attitude as well, right? Decoding the dog whistles in politics. So another thing that was interesting was to find how few students actually understood what a dog whistle is when I was given a lecture. But we, of course, use that term dog whistle politics to talk about messages that politicians put out there that may sail over the heads of most people in the audience, but will reach the audience that they want to move. Dog whistle politics. One of the most famous examples of that might be the Willie Horton ad that was created to support the candidacy of George H.W. Bush when he was running against Michael Dukakis. It was an ad that talked about a convicted murderer who was let out on a furlough program and then committed another rape and murder while he was out, right? And the ad showed this very scary looking black guy and said he was out on this furlough and committed these crimes, and then noted that Dukakis supported the furlough program and allowed this guy to go out. Now, to the mainstream audience, it's an ad that says, hey, you know, this guy supported a program that doesn't work. But to people who are frightened of black people committing violent crimes against them, there's another message there. This is the guy who's going to turn these dangerous black criminals loose in your neighborhood. And it can be very effective. I talked to Dave Weigel from Slate Magazine about covering Newt Gingrich and covering the Republican primaries for president early last year, and he said Newt Gingrich won the South Carolina primary right after running an ad that played up some of the attacks that he had been making against President Obama that had some of those same themes, where he called him the food stamp president, right? Where he had said earlier in that year, he said in January, Newt Gingrich had, that he was going to go to the NAACP convention and show them why they should value paychecks instead of food stamps. Right, like black folks need to be told that they want a job instead of food stamps. But those were dog whistle messages, right? Meant to reach the people who might be predisposed to respond to them. And he won the South Carolina primary, if you remember. So here's another question that you might want to answer. Herman Cain, at one point, was a front runner for the Republican nomination for president. This despite the fact that he had never really been elected to an office before. This despite the fact that he had a book out and it sort of seemed like maybe he was turning his candidacy into a book tour. I know how important it is to sell books, but man. And this despite the fact that he had a habit of saying some really stupid stuff in public, right? And this is all before the sexual harassment scandal that eventually ended his candidacy. So given that, why might some conservatives like Herman Cain, why was he at the top of the leaderboard for a while when there were like six or seven or eight people running for president on the Republican side? Beth, we got somebody right here.
Because it makes them look like they're not, don't have problems with someone like President Obama, so then they're not racist.
Right. The Tea Party and some extreme conservatives were being accused of being racist. So what could be less racist than wanting to elect a black guy president,
like,
right?
To me, this sounds really bad, but when I saw that he was running for the Republican nomination, I just thought he was an Uncle Tom, like someone that caters, like Sidney Poitier, which I love Sidney Poitier, but something that caters to the white audience and makes them feel less racist because he aligns with their beliefs.
Because he's in line with their beliefs, yeah. And you know, I will tell you, number one, I sympathize with you. I had that same reaction. What I don't want to do is associate black Republicans with this idea that they might be an Uncle Tom, because I do think it's possible to be a black person and be a Republican and have those views and not be considered you're betraying your race or something like that. But I do think it's odd that one of the central criticisms of Barack Obama when he first ran for president was that he didn't have enough experience. And he had been a state senator and a U.S. senator. And now this guy has the possibility of winning the Republican nomination, and he hasn't been elected to anything. I mean, how is that possible? I think some conservatives like Herman Cain, frankly, because he talks about race the way they do. He doesn't believe that racism holds black people back. He doesn't believe that institutional racism is a problem. He believes that people should work hard, and if they apply themselves, they'll be successful just like him. And these people can have their ideas sort of validated by a black guy, right? He talks about race the way they do. But unfortunately, I think sometimes that also, again, ends up encouraging stereotyping and validating prejudice in a way that makes me very uncomfortable. The Katrina effect. Another part of the book talks about the Katrina effect. I remember interviewing Brian Williams, the anchor for NBC News. He was still in New Orleans not too long after Katrina had impacted. He was like grabbing duct tape and taping up a window, and you know, he was in the thick of it, and he seemed to really feel like he was in the middle of some really important reporting, and that can be an exciting thing. And so I was talking to him about Hurricane Katrina and how the impact on the New Orleans area had revealed all of these problems with poverty and race. And he said to me then very earnestly that if this does not start a national conversation on race and poverty in America, we will have not done our jobs. And then I caught up with him 5 years later and I said, I don't think we had that national conversation unless I was out of the country when it happened. And he had to admit that part of the problem was that my audience would rather watch Entourage. It's harder to get people engaged in these conversations, right? I also think, though, one reason why people don't understand the poor in America is because the news media is not covering poverty enough. I went to the Project for Excellence in Journalism, and they keep track of the top 50 news outlets in the country and what they report on. And so I went to them and I said, I have this suspicion that poverty doesn't get covered a lot. Can you tell me how much of all the news stories in these top 50 news outlets for the whole year, how much poverty got covered in 2009, 2010, and 2011? And they said, well, in 2009, about 2% of the stories involved poverty. Now, bear in mind, this was 1 year after we had this tremendous meltdown in our economy. And people were losing their homes left and right. People were losing their jobs left and right. 2% of the stories were centered on poverty. In 2010, they couldn't give me a number for the percentage of stories centered on poverty, except to say that it was a little bit above zero. That's how low it was.
Now the king told the boogeyman, you have to let the record drop. The oil down the desert way has been shaken to the top. The sheik, he drove his Cadillac, he went a-cruising down the beach.
jump right off the edge of this planet.
The youth are extremely bitter.
Discrimination may go, but prejudice will always be there.
Take Satan by the gonads and slings him right off the edge of this planet.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.